So this is the Thursday, July 17th, 2008, Zone 3 Advisory Committee meeting. And Mr. Benedix, if you could check the roll, see who's here.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Gehring. Ms. Dean?
Here.
Mr. Ehring?
Here.
Mr. Ashton?
Here.
Mr. Costello?
Here.
Chairman Gehring?
I'm here.
Mr. Wallace?
Here.
And Mr. Reynolds? We have a quorum, Mr. Gehring.
Okay, thank you. All right, this is time for public comment. For anyone who wishes to comment on anything that is not on the agenda, is there anyone in the public who wishes to comment? Seeing none, on to the meeting minutes. Has everybody had a chance to take a look at their minutes? Any questions or comments or corrections or a motion?
I'll move that we approve the minutes of, let's see, what's the date? 15th, May 15th, 2008.
Second.
Discussion. Mr. Benedix, on, I notice on under item one, call to order, you designated CSA 12A. Is that correct? I thought it was CSA 12.
I think it's CSA 12.
Okay,
I will correct that. I don't know where that came from.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
that's fine with me.
We got a motion and a second. Any other comments? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Looks like we carried unanimously on that. I don't see Mr. Mellon in the audience. Mr. Benedix, are you going to cover for him?
I did not get a response from Don. I know he's been very busy with the quagga mussel inspection and decontamination procedures. I did send him a request for a report, but I did not hear from him since last week. So apparently we would not receive a report.
Well, we'd rather have him effectively dealing with quagga mussels than perhaps giving a report. All right. How about, what about the rec? Okay, how about the rec area transfer issue?
Yes, as your committee recalls, we have discussed a couple of times about transfer of the Lopez Recreation Area to the General Services Department of the county. That has been effectuated. The Board of Supervisors did approve an agreement between the Flood Control District, Zone 3, and the County Parks and Rec Department, or Park and Rec Division of General Services, to take over the recreation area operations. So that was effective July 1st. And our operations staff will be supporting General Services, Parks and Rec, as necessary, really as called on from Parks and Rec. They'll be utilizing the services of FRM consultant to continue to operate the wastewater system and the water system. We provided information regarding an outstanding capital improvement remedial list, capital project list that we have been keeping, maintaining, that has been unfunded, but we provided that to Parks and Rec, and we've notified the various agencies that the County General Services Department will now be the operator and be responsible for those two systems. So it's been pretty seamless. We haven't had any issues as far as I'm aware of in the transfer so far. Just wanted to give you a brief report on that.
Yeah. In the event that Zone 3 staff is called upon to help out, is there a funding mechanism for that?
Yes. We have set up a work order account whereby the County General Services budget would reimburse Zone 3 for any staff time that was required to do that. We anticipate that'll be very minimal.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of Mr. Benedix on this issue? I see none on the right side. Mr. Ashton.
Yeah. How thin is your employee being drawn out there with this addition of the inspections with regard to the mussel area? Are we going to need more employees to implement the continued inspections, or what?
With respect to the quagga mussels?
Right.
The Parks Department is doing all of that inspection. Our operations staff, Public Works, is not involved in that.
So we don't have anything to do with that?
That's correct.
All about the inspection portion?
Yes, as far as the physical inspection of the boats coming in and the decontamination that they're doing, the spraying down and washing and the forms and that type of thing, that's all being done by Parks. Our water quality laboratory staff is doing sampling. Basically, we're pulling a rope with some apparatus out of the water once a month while we are doing inspections for other things to check to see if we have any indications of the quagga mussels. So it's very, very minimal additional time. We're not doing any testing yet to see if the veligers, which are the larva stage of that mollusk, is in the water yet. We haven't done that because it takes a long time and it's expensive. So we have very minimal additional cost for that particular issue.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else from any of the members on that item? And what about continued reporting, Mr. Benedict?
Yes, as you're aware, the reason that we were involved in the rec area operation is because it was part of the original funding mechanism for the Lopez Dam and the water supply facilities and recreation facilities. I just wanted to bring to your committee, I guess, just entertain a question to you if you wanted to keep receiving a recreation report from General Services Department, Parks and Rec, at each meeting. We've had, with some missing meetings or some missing reports from time to time, but generally we've always had that, and I don't know if, since really at this point in time, the legal responsibility for the operation of the recreation area now is not the legal responsibility of Zone 3. It has been transferred by legal agreement to the County of San Luis Obispo. So certainly there's some impacts there that could happen based on leakage or events from the wastewater system, but I would certainly bring that to you as if that came up. So I just wanted you to entertain or make a conscious decision that we wanted to continue to have a Parks and Rec report, what's going on, have Parks and Rec come and advise you of that. So that's open for your discussion and determination.
Okay, thank you. So what do the committee members think about that?
I think it'd be a very good idea if we got, say, once every 6 months or something like that, a report as to how things are going, and just so we can stay on top of the recreational area. Or what does everybody else think?
Could you pull your microphone a little closer?
Yeah, what would everybody else think about that?
I kind of agree. I think that we should have a periodic report on how things are going, but if we no longer have the legal obligation and we're not going to be involved in the month-to-month operations, I don't know that we necessarily need to receive a regular report every 2 months, but I think some sort of periodic report would be in line.
Yeah. Mrs. Dean?
I'm in agreement with that, especially since we're looking at the quagga mussels and this does get televised and people get some information about that and what's going on, and we're talking a serious kind of threat to our water quality and how we operate the system. So a periodic report would be good, especially now that we're starting up this quagga mussel inspection. So I'd like to see it every couple months or so, something like that. Okay. I think the reports are very valuable and it's nice to televise it so people know.
Okay. Mr. Wallace, anything?
How would the committee feel about a report every other meeting of ours, which would be three times a year rather than twice a year at the six-month interval? Unless there was something that was unusual that came up that we needed to know about, but that would give General Services staff a little relief in having to come to meetings, but every other time seems to be a reasonable alternative.
Okay. I'm seeing what looks to be consensus at three times a year, unless someone disagrees. Is that good enough for you, Mr. Benedict?
That's fine. I'll go ahead and plan on scheduling it that way. And, of course, obviously, if there was something that came up with respect to the quagga mussels or the operation of the rec facilities, we would bring that to you and let you know that. As you can see, it's on your agenda. The quagga mussels is on the agenda later in the meeting, and we'll continue to bring that to you until it sort of dies down or we think we have it under control, if that's at all possible.
Okay, thank you. Do any of the members want to bring anything else up on this item? Okay, thank you. So it looks like we're up to operations report, Mr. Benedict.
Yes, the current operation of the plant is at 4.5 million gallons per day. State water deliveries are approximately 1.4 million gallons per day. The environmental releases are 5.5 million gallons per day. We raised them within the last month or so because of some request of the farmers and some inability of them to take water out of the creek for their irrigation and some of the heat that we've had down there. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. We've done some treatment for algae in the terminal reservoir. We haven't been feeding carbon recently. The taste and odor has been pretty good for the last, I believe, month or so, maybe a little bit longer. The capacity of the reservoir at Lopez Lake is now approximately 70%. It was 70% about 2 weeks ago when we had our advisory committee or a technical advisory committee meeting. We have reduced the manned hours at the plant from 16 hours per day manned to 12 hours per day. Basically, we've done that by just overlapping one of the late shifts. So the person who usually came in around 4 o'clock and worked till midnight now comes in at noon or so and works till 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, which makes him more effective because he has some other resources to assist him during that four-hour overlap period. That's been working fairly well. We've had one problem with that chemical feed system that's required, actually this week, the same standby operator to come back each night, like about 3 in the morning for the last 3 or 4 nights. The chlorine dioxide system has been behaving strangely, and we haven't been able to get our distributor, our technical support out. Probably won't be able to come out until next week. We've been working on that. And also, we did, this is sort of peripheral to operations, but we conducted a hazardous spill assessment for the new plant. We had a consultant come in and walk through the site with a couple of our safety officers and go through all the areas of containment, the potential for leakages and spills, and how things could possibly get out of hand or out of control. And also, I did have them go up to the recreation area and look at the wastewater treatment system up there to do the same thing. So I'll be getting a separate sort of a technical memorandum on it. There's any corrections or issues we should consider up at the recreation area, and we'll work with General Services on providing that to them and making sure that that happens as it's appropriate. I anticipate that the assessment for the plant will be sent to us probably within a month or so. I know they were writing it up right after they finished. I'm not aware of any particular problems that they found. I will note also operationally that I believe that there was I know we had a leak in the hypochlorite liquid tank, which is one of the large chemical tanks on the site. It was some fitting leaked or broke somehow. I don't have the details yet of it. We had, I think, something in the range of about 600 gallons leak down the tank into the concrete containment chamber underneath it, so the chamber contained the hypochlorite material as it was supposed to. A little bit of concern to us is that there is a float in that containment chamber that's supposed to have an alarm that tells the operator there's a leak, something is filling up that's not supposed to be, and that alarm did not go off. The float didn't work, so we have our operators have put those float alarm systems on a regular maintenance to make sure that something's not gummed up or whatever and that they are operational. But there was no problem with it. It did work the way it was supposed to. I haven't found the details whether that was before or after the spill assessment happened. It was within a few days as far as I know. John, do you know if it was before that happened? Or It was after the spill assessment. Okay. So it worked out well. And I don't know how it occurred, but I understood it occurred during the night. So I don't know how valves just break or something leaks on its own, but there was no problems with it other than a little bit of leakage and cleanup. So that concludes my report, Mr. Gehring.
Okay. Thank you for that report. And questions for Mr. Benedict? Maybe we can start with Mr. Ashton.
In general? Or
in general. Anything you wish.
I don't know if this broke time. Dean, I think, was at the meeting. We had a RAC meeting. I think it was a couple of meetings ago. We have a habit at the RAC meetings that we have all these different water entities out there, and they rotate reports on what's going on as far as water in their particular entities and how they're set up and that. And at that particular time, we had Ted's city was there, and it was Mr. Delsai, who was since retired. I think it was one of his last endeavors for the city there, and he presented a overall review report, which I got an extra copy here, brought along of the water as it pertains to Pismo Beach over there, that they're only at 83% of their capacities and so forth. And that a couple of interesting things that arose there, as you know, that they're on basically, I believe, a shale base, so that's why they have their wells over in my city there, and so they don't have ways to put stuff or replenish stuff back into the soil, I guess, recapture any water that they generate over there. So, and he also pointed out it's not the rate payers are not that interested at this point. But one thing he pointed out about their waste facility over there, and I think I put pretty good notes on the thing, their production capacity is about 1.9 million gallons per day. Basically, it goes out in the ocean. And here we're water bodies, and we operate within our county as, I think, somewhat, not always in conjunction with each other, but it seems to me that's a lot of water going out in the ocean that we can use for something. I know we talked in the past about releasing, we have to release so much water for different things off the dam and all that. Why can't this water somehow be captured and piped or whatever it is and meet the needs of in the creek or whatever in that, and maybe save releasing some of the water up in the dam there, because it seems like a big waste. The ocean is taking about 1.9 million gallons a day that could be utilized that way, because I think as we go along and drought conditions prevail, and if you listen to some of the scientists out there, they say that we're in a global warming trend, which is going to be an ongoing drought deal. We may have to look at these things. So maybe it might behoove us to look at an early stage instead of when we get into a critical stage here. So do you have any comments, or has it been discussed in the past about for the county or joint efforts? I know we're in joint efforts in our city with looking for water sources with Aurora Grandy there and that there. Is there a way that we can utilize that perhaps to satisfy the release demands over there on the dam? Or
yeah, Mr. Ashton is I think he's questioning whether we should be thinking about using reclaimed wastewater to satisfy downstream release obligations, and I have to remember that Mr. Wallace's firm has done a study in that regard, or at least in part on that.
Yeah, just a brief review. There's been 3-4 major studies about reclamation for the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District in Oceano there that serves Roy Grandy Grover in Oceano. The primary thrust of the earlier studies were to look towards the Cienega Valley for use on crops out there. And the problem always has been there's no buyers for the water. As you know, there's probably never a buyer until there is a crisis, but there were no buyers for the water. We even looked at the golf courses on the Napomo Mesa to help alleviate some of the pumpage down there. And then, in fact, we had a tentative contract with the Unocal refinery to utilize some of the reclaimed water for their operations there at the refinery. But again, that fell out primarily because of the cost and the long pipeline that would need to be constructed to go down there. More recently, as Jim's indicating, we looked at several different options. Again, going to the freeway for landscape irrigation, going to parks in the different cities for landscape irrigation, and then going up to Lopez Dam to release water in spreading basins or directly to the creek, which would then offset the use of our potable water behind the dam and its releases on behalf of environmental reasons or agricultural reasons. Two problems on that. The major problem was the cost, and the cost was extreme. I can't remember precisely what the cost was, but it was quite a bit of money per acre foot to be delivered up there. The pipeline was quite a long pipeline. And one of the other concerns was the quality of the water that might be different from the water that is being released from the dam and how that would affect the fish. So those conclusions were reached in a study that was published probably 4 to 5 years ago, probably 4 years ago, awaiting perhaps more study through the HCP on the creek and where that might turn out with respect to environmental releases that were required for that. As a different thrust on that, Pismo has looked at taking some of their water to the oil field operations there in Price Canyon and probably using some of that for steam generation. Again, that hasn't matured. So there's been a number of occasions on which this has been looked at, and sooner or later, one of these will mature to the point where we'll need it and we'll have to implement it. But I think a lot of the planning, a lot of the thinking, alternate routes have been looked at. The use of old Unocal pipelines that have been abandoned has been looked at. So there's been a number of possibilities there, but nobody has stepped up to be a purchaser of the water at this point. Brief explanation.
If I could.
Yes.
When we did our wastewater new wastewater treatment plant, we conducted a study or had a study done by Corollo Engineers, and they came up with a cost estimates in distribution and how we would go about the use of that wastewater right out of our wastewater treatment plant. At that time, we made an offer and sent to each one of the individual cities, agencies here, asking, well, number one, volunteering to make our study available to everyone, and whether or not they wish to consider using some of this water for replacement of agriculture or this kind of thing. And at that time, we did not receive back any requests to even consider it or want to even study it further, because you would have to tertiary treat this water before you could use it for potable crops, and that requires filtration and reverse osmosis systems, and they're costly. But the biggest cost involved in the entire recycled water use is basically, or this tertiary water, is really the distribution system in order to take it from, say, a plant to the areas where you can put it in parks and use it for that type of service. The PXP water that you talked about, they really gained approval from the Regional Water Quality Control Board to treat on a basis of reverse osmosis and put water into the Pismo Creek. It's my understanding, though, that they are also making this water available, which is an oil field water, for temporary. It's really temporary timing. It's not permanent. And on that basis, Not a lot of people wanted to sign up for that water, and but they are making it available to adjoining agricultural areas, and whether or not they're going to come and get it is still up in the air. Nobody has stated that they're going to move forward. And I don't know, John. I think I heard that that was being appealed to dumping that water. I'm not sure whether that's the case or not. So, yeah.
Oh.
So yeah, that's what I know about it. But we still have this. We still have a report that I'll make available to anybody. In fact, we offer that report to anybody that wants to take a look at it and the costs and this kind of thing. And any other agency here or any other city in the Five Cities area that Zone 3 is really interested in doing anything now, we certainly would like to sit down and talk to people about it.
Jim?
Yes, Mr. Ashton.
I've kind of been looking at some of this here, and there are several areas in our state where they do heavily use reclaimed water. I believe Orange County is one of them there and been quite successful at it there. I realize that many think we're just a Cal County, we don't have the population that, but and the cost may be prohibitive now, but what is it going to be 10 years from now? And at what you make up putting money into now may save you a lot more money in the future there. I just can't see that many gallons going out to the sea there. I got another article that kind of ties in with that there. I get this Western Water deal, and it was found about the drought conditions there and how they're going to heavily affect small water entities, which I guess we have a lot of them in our county there. They can't readily meet the drought conditions there. Your principal source of water, for instance, in the state water, and that which we receive a lot of it coming down here, is the fact that their principal lake up there is Lake Oroville that holds it, and it's only currently right now at 48% of its capacity, and that where it normally should be about 58% of its capacity, and they've already made announcements that they won't be able to deliver some of their at least 35% of their commitments to the state water people down here. So how long this drought continues on, I know it's been cylindrical over many years in that, but who knows in that. So I think it behooves us to maybe what may look like something out in outer space today, it may be our salvation tomorrow. I know Rio Grande and Gower Beach are heavily considering all kinds of options there. And yes, there's a cost factor involved. We even looked at Nacio Mendo water and the cost of piping and everything else. The Pomo Mesa up there was looking at believe it or not, at the desalinization deal and then piping it up to their deal there. So I think it behooves us to look at all aspects there, because I hate to think, you know, we've done this historically in the past, not us per se, but our country is always wait till we get into some climate disaster and that, and then all of a sudden now we go into it and it'll end up costing you more money in the long run. Maybe we ought to have some foresight and look ahead on some of these things.
Well, thank you. I agree that it does look like we're heading into a water crisis in the state. Any comments, Mr. Costello?
Well, I have to agree that it seems like a waste that the 1.2 million gallons or whatever it is from Pismo's going into the ocean, and whatever we're putting in from South County Sanitary. I think we should stay on top of this, and it may not be appealing today, but as Mr. Ashton says, as time goes by, we're going to have to look at all these options. Let's just not forget about it, but keep it in our minds as time goes by. And when the time is right, I'm sure we're going to make use of it.
Thank you for those comments. Mr. Wallace. Oh,
okay. Jim, if the committee would like, be happy to have our staff that conducted the study for South County to come to our next meeting just to give a review of that report. It was a grant-funded report, and so it was done relatively inexpensively to the district, but be happy to review the alignments and the alternatives of the things that we talked about, although the cost will probably have been adjusted to today's date. At least you can get a relative reference between cost of different alternatives, if the committee would like, we'll come back to you at the next meeting or sometime at whenever it's convenient.
Well, I think that's a great idea.
That's a good idea.
You're willing to do that,
sure,
please do.
Be happy to.
And about the costs, would there be significant effort to update to today's dollars on those costs per acre foot to take it up?
I think that we can get, again, just an order of magnitude update on it. It won't be precise to go back through all the engineering estimates, but I think just an order of magnitude using ENR index or some relatively easy tool to use.
Okay, great. Mr. Benedict's on, that would be the meeting of September, I guess.
Yes, if that's what you'd like to schedule, I can contact Mr. Wallace's office.
Sure.
And
what's the date of that, Dean?
On the bottom of our agenda,
September 18th.
Okay, provided that Mr. Tanaka is not on vacation, I would be volunteering for that.
Okay, you want me to just contact him directly, John?
Go ahead and send me the email, and I'll discuss it with him so we won't surprise him.
Well, thank you, Mr. Wallace. I'm sure we'll very much appreciate that report.
No problem. Be happy to.
Now, do any of the members have any other questions of Mr. Benedict's regarding the operations report? Seeing none, it looks like we're moving on to old business, and I think Mr. Benedict's is still on tap for that item.
Yes, I just wanted to give you, a brief summary of the upgrade report. I have presented to the Technical Advisory Committee actually in June a summary, a pretty detailed summary. It's a 3-page list of all the items that are still outstanding in the plant that relate to the upgrade and finalizing things that didn't quite get done correctly or need to be revised or fixed or added or whatever. And there, I have 44 items listed on here. They're grouped by Black & Veatch issues that are retrofit design, the Paul Corporation, which is the membrane system. I have three main things that I'm working with the Paul Corporation still on. I anticipate they will have staff come out within a couple of weeks. We're going to sit down and go over some issues and try to make some resolutions on those. We still have some minor site repair and construction items, the dissolved air flotation cover retrofit. We're working on that. I think we have a good direction to go on that. We've got some firm prices on a couple of options just recently. Kennedy Jenks, as you know, has done an audit, and that should be finalized within the next month or so with some costs, so I can bring that to you and provide that information. Our plant staff is also out there creatively thinking of how to do things easier, cheaper, faster, and maybe not spend as much money for some other retrofit items. So we're in the process of entertaining those. And then kind of a leftover list is some of the capital items. We talked about the sludge bed, which has to have some retrofits done to it, some water quality station work, and then the spill assessment, which has been completed. So these are in process. There's a few of them that I'd like to get done in the next 6 months. The DAF cover, we have to do a performance test and get Paul off their contract and resolve that contract and get the last Black & Veatch issues done. So I'm working through that list. I've had a couple of staff members leave, transfer out of the town, promotions or whatever, so I'm down a couple of people. So I'm still focusing on this to try to clean it up and get it done, and I'll continue to do that with the other work that's going on. So that's just a brief summary. We are going through it. We are knocking them out one at a time with everybody's pretty much cooperation, but it's taking a little bit of time to get this done. I think I mentioned to you that the SRF loan, we requested an extension on that. And as far as I know, they have not told us no, and at this point that means yes, because it would have expired June 30th as far as the finishing of funding of that. So Department of Health Services has told me that no news is good news, so we're continuing to look at finishing these things up. Probably the two largest things we don't have a bill for are Black & Veatch's services and the Paul Corporation's final services or for their equipment, which they haven't billed us for because they haven't finished up their work yet. So we have funding to do some of these things under the upgrade. They are attached in a portion of the upgrade, so we'll be finishing that up. And I'll bring that to you as it comes up, let you know what we've finished that are significant.
Okay, thank you for that report. Questions? Mr. Costello.
Yeah, Dean, is there anything extraordinary on that list of 44 that was unexpected or isn't a normal and routine thing that might have gone wrong that will be fixed? And is there anything that's not funded or not within whatever funding sources we had set up to deal with all that?
The only thing that the highest priority item is really to do some sludge bed improvement work. I think functionally that's a big problem, and that has been budgeted with this year's budget. We've budgeted $300,000 to start that process. We have been operating the plant since the end of May, so about 14, 15 months. We have added a lot of streamlining fail-safes into the system. So I would say, to answer your question, I don't believe we have anything that's extraordinary other than some things that are really annoying or really difficult to sort of work around. But we're working on that, and we're sort of getting used to it, and the plant's working better on its own. So it is operating well. I have to keep focusing on the good operations of it because I have all these problems I'm trying to take care of, and the guys are getting more comfortable out there at the plant. So I'm trying not to be too negative about it, but the list is mine to take care of in between all the other things that go on in the utilities division. So it's probably more annoying to me than anybody else, but it's just on the top of my mind and my list, so that's what I'm going through. So to answer your question, not really.
Thank you.
Since we're on the left side, Mr. Ashton, any questions?
None at this time.
Mr. Ehring, Mr. Wallace, Mrs. Dean. And you're including the raising of the DAF cover in that list of things that are not terribly of concern?
Yes, I am. It's difficult, but I think we have a solution at this point. And once I know that we do, I'll bring that back to you and kind of tell you where we're going to head. It looks like it's not as expensive as I anticipated as it initially looked.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions on plant upgrade? Looks, Mr. Dean, like we're up to spillway raise report.
Yes. Again, the topic here is the consideration of a preliminary analysis to raise the spillway to gain a little bit more storage when we did have enough rainfall to have additional storage in the Lopez Dam. We have a preliminary report that's been submitted to us actually a couple of times. The July TAC meeting, I took the draft report to the TAC committee members. It's not complete, but I wanted them to give me some feedback on it, and I think it was is a good thing for us to do because, as I'll explain in a minute, there were some positive things that we're doing with it. At this point, the only information that I have is I have an approximate cost of doing the spillway raising. I don't know if you want to switch to the screen here, and I could maybe leave that up here. I'll describe that in a minute, but the concept that was brought up was basically a movable gate that hinges on the bottom with an inflatable pillow underneath it, if you will. And hydraulically, what happens is air blows up that balloon, and the balloon raises. Since it's underneath the gate hinges from the bottom, it swings up, and you raise the level of the water because it raises the spillway height, and that's adjustable to a certain extent. Preliminary information that I got from URS was that they were talking something in the range of 3 feet to 6 feet of raising the spillway height, and these are all preliminary information now, but and the cost that they came up with is about $4.5 million. So simple math tells you that if the numbers that I were using was about $4.5 million, and as we had discussed before, each foot is about 1,000 acre feet, a little bit less, depending on how high. The higher you go, the more water you get per foot. So If it was $4.5 million and you raised it, I was using 3 feet because that's what we originally talked about. 3 feet equals 3,000 acre feet approximately. And if that happened every year, that water would cost you $1,500 per acre feet, which is pretty attractive. The issue is how often would that happen? And that's one of the concerns that we had. URS was to do a preliminary yield analysis, and it was suggested by the TAC at our last meeting that URS was having some problems in getting the data and utilizing the data, and they came to the realization that really there's three time periods or different scenarios that have occurred at Lopez, and I can summarize them for you. From 1969 to 1986, the reservoir was operated as a at close to spillway level because we didn't have the environmental issues that we have now, and the dam spilled from 14 of 18 years. That would have gained us a lot of additional capacity if we were to do it during that time. We don't operate that dam that way now. From 1986 to 2004, the reservoir spilled only 2 times out of 19 years. However, that was during a combination of dry years and during a time when the dam was being retrofitted. There was a maximum level, which was substantially less than 100%, that it had to be kept at so that we didn't have additional pressure and stress on the dam itself. So that's not a true representation either. The last 4 years, the dam hasn't spilled at all. That may not necessarily be typical either. So the TAC suggested that since the Stetson consultant who is helping us with the HCP has done significant work in yield and flows, that they go ahead and take the data they have from the last 40-odd years and use that and provide to URS a preliminary yield estimate based on the depth of knowledge that they had. So we've asked them to do that, and they've agreed to do that. It won't cost us any additional money. Stetson will provide that to URS. URS won't charge us for it, and they'll incorporate in the report. So I don't have that yet. It should be done within a couple of weeks. And the remaining item that URS is to do is to do some sort of interview with Division of Dam Safety of the state to find out if there's any fatal flaws with this kind of an idea. And I don't have that yet in the report. There are some other textural changes that have been requested, the TAC also requested in the report. So I haven't brought it to you yet because basically it's only, effectively, only 25% of the information is provided yet. But I wanted to give you a report that they are working on it. We got a little bit different direction to go with one of the tasks, and we should have that completed probably within a month or so. So that's my report on the spillway race.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Mr. Benedict on that issue? Mrs. Dean?
I'm just seeing the connection with the HCP that we haven't got and what's going on with the spills. And it's kind of like you have to put the puzzle pieces together and they all have to come together before you can get a real answer. And so I'll be interested to know about the HCP as it comes up here.
Yes, right. Thank you. Mr. Wallace.
Dean, were they analyzing several different types of spillway dams, the inflatable dam, the labyrinth type, or was it just, were they going back to the inflatable type?
This was the only one that they had discussed as far as costs go. I hadn't asked, or we hadn't said, give us options for different things, I think, and I don't know why. I don't have the answer that I can ask them that.
No, that's all right. This is probably the least expensive, but I didn't know that they were looking at others as well.
I don't know why they didn't, John, but this was the only one. I think we left it open when we asked for a proposal, but they only came back with this, so I probably should at least get an answer to that question. Okay.
Mr. Ehring.
The only thing that I would have to add to this is until, as Pamela said, until we get this HCP process under our belt, I can't see that we're going to be able to fill the dam, even if we have additional height, okay, in the spillway. But I would ask, in a case of a hurry-up kind of a effort, if it were necessary, how long would it take to install this type of engineering?
URS estimated it'd take 5 years to go from yes, we're going to proceed to installation.
Well, that's something you can't do in an emergency situation, can we?
It can be done pretty quickly, but it takes a long time to get permits. And it raises the same issues that the HCP is at the root of our request for HCP, and that's how much water we can store. We request to store more than 50,000 acre feet in that dam, 53,000 or 56,000. It will trigger another permit application to DWR to store more water, even beyond what the HCP is supposed to retroactively affirm that that's what we do use. So that's a whole other issue, one of the many issues involved in doing this, if we proceed that way.
What kind of effort and cost is involved in getting pre-construction, starting the permitting process? Okay, I mean, how much of this $4.5 million is the design permits questions, this kind of thing?
I would estimate that probably on this particular project, at least 50, if not 60-70% of that cost is for soft costs, not hard construction costs.
Of the $4.5 million?
Yes. And that was even noted in their draft report that the costs are going to be, the cost of a normal project will be skewed because of the environmental impacts and the permitting impacts and the engineering impacts and reassessments and coordination that would have to be done.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dean, if I'll be a cockeyed optimist here and say that at some point we're going to solve this HCP issue, and it will be a thing of the past, but we'll get there at some point. But if we spend $4.5 million on this project, is that a one-time cost? What are we talking about on an annual basis once it's in and installed? And how long will this device remain viable?
I think this is permanently permanent. The operation of it is very, very minimal. One of our comments back to URS was that you need to make sure the control system for this is included at the appropriate cost, because it was our understanding from the Nacimiento project that when they're installing something similar up there, that the control system alone was $2.5 million just for the control system. And they went back and affirmed that that system is a lot more complex and does some other things that ours wouldn't need to do. But it would be virtually no operational cost, other than when we had to look at it and we had to make some judgments about how high to raise it or when to lower it, that type of thing. So you don't exercise them, like a fire hydrant. It's pretty minimal as far as operation.
Well, that being the case, then once we've spent the $4.5 million, let's say we had 2 years in a 10-year period that we were able to get the 3 feet,
yeah.
Then that cuts that cost per foot in half.
That's correct. And I think that's probably the simple math, is that you figure out it's $4.5 million for how many thousand acre feet. That's a good number. The problem is you have to divide that number by how infrequently you can do that. And if it's once every 10 years, then it's really 10 times that cost for those 10 years. If it's 3 years in a row, then it's that cost for 3 years in a row. So you'd have to average it out over some type of a 20 or 30-year period. To
right, but well, once we've spent the $4.5 million,
that's it.
It's spent.
Yes.
And then you'd be able to.
You wouldn't see a large line item on, say, the budget that would say $100,000 a year. We have to go out there and do something. It would be wrapped up in our operational cost.
Well, I'd be very interested to see the projections from the contractor, the consultant. when they analyze how often this might be of avail to us once all the other condition, once all the other conditions have been met. So, thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mr. Ashton, comments?
I just have some concerns as a person from the streets there. I don't profess to be any expert on our future in the water and that, but so the bottom line is if we want to conserve water down here and raise our dam and that, we have to get special dispensation from somebody above that. Is there reasoning behind that? Is that a safety feature? Or is it an environmental impact? Or why is it here? We're talking about drought conditions all over the state, and we want to make improvements to save the deal, but then we have to go through a bureaucratic deal just to institute these things here. So maybe you can enlighten me while we're going through all this bureaucratic deal. And there's a big expense, as you pointed out, because the construction itself is minimal compared to what you have to go through all this process.
Well, I'm not familiar with the detailed regulations other than the specific reason that is in back of the HCP, that the reason that we have to get a revised permit and which triggered the HCP is because the water that we use stays in the reservoir longer than 30 days. And if I understand correctly, state water law says you can pass that amount of water through and you can use that. But if you store it, then you have to get a permit. And we don't do that every month, but some months we do. And when it's not raining and it's behind several lawsuits or agreements that have come up that have determined you can do this, you have a water riparian right, and here you don't have a right. I don't know what all those are, but that's my understanding of why. Because we've been doing it that way, and it's been okay for 30 years, and somebody identified that we weren't doing it the way that our original permit technically said, so here we are, $1 million and 10 years later and still don't have anything, but we're still doing it. So we have to comply, because otherwise we could be sued and eventually stopped using that water, I suppose, if it worse came to worse. And that's not to mention all the other environmental issues. I know someone brought up, I think, at the last meeting that, well, when they design the dam, you design the dam to have everything inundated up to the very top of the spillway. Yeah, good point. So why do we even need to do an EIR? I don't know the answer to that, but the answer probably is it's a project and you're going to build something. It doesn't matter what the EIR was done. You know, there was no EIR done 40 years ago. So you got to go through the current process as it's interpreted today.
Oh, I see someone from the audience with a question. Please come up.
Marilee Hyman, District 3 representative to the Water Resources Advisory Committee. This is really a simple question, Mr. Chairman. I don't know anything about bladders. Which side is the water on, the right or the left?
On your right.
On the right. Thank you.
You know, there are a couple things that I could bring up that I remember, and one is that there is a rather old study that estimated the safe yield from a device somewhat similar to the inflatable dam or gate shown on the screen that was done by Lawrence Fisk and McFarland in about 1985. And my recollection is that study at that time, which was admittedly at the end of a wet cycle, estimated the safe yield of that kind of a device in round numbers at about 1,000 acre feet, perhaps as low as 800, but somewhere in round numbers at about 1,000 acre feet. If you run the numbers on 1,000 acre foot of safe yield in a $4.5 million project, it's rather an attractive water yield for the cost. Now, we need to keep in mind that because that inflatable dam raises the water level 3 feet and by some calculation might result in 3,000 or 4,000 acre feet of storage,
bring back the report, the final report from URS with all this information to you at your next meeting. And I'll try to provide that. If you'd like, I could send it to you when I get it and it's ready to release rather than wait to the agenda. That's what I would like to do. And we'll bring it to the TAC, hopefully, and be able to discuss it with a recommendation to you for the September, your September meeting.
Mr. Wallace.
I had a question and observation, Dean. Jim's absolutely right. The storage is not the safe yield, or it's not the addition to the safe yield, as was demonstrated by the previous study by LFM. I had a question, and maybe I'm still advocating some of the temporary measures that I was familiar with many years ago on another dam in LA County. I don't know if it's possible or not to ask our consultant, but the idea there was on the recession curve of the hydrograph at the end of the storm season, if we had spillway flow, a row of sandbags across the spillway, increasing the height of the spillway by 1 foot would save 1,000 acre feet. The cost of the sandbags and the visqueen to do that is peanuts compared to the $2.5 million that we're talking about. But it was a temporary measure. I don't know if you could ask the consultant if that kind of an approach would trigger the environmental as well as the structural DSOD types of concerns that the permanent solution here would. Might be interesting to know if they view that as a temporary one-shot deal, because you would use that water relatively rapidly with distribution, both for environmental as well as distribution to our agencies.
I'm just thinking of actually seeing my operations people on there on the dam doing that when that dam is almost full, and I'm trying to visualize how I convince them to do that.
You do it.
I would think I'd hire a contractor. But that's a good point. I guess seriously though, I would think that, you know, it may be even more of a flood control facility. I mean, you could call it what you wanted. You know, a foot of sandbags is generally for flood protection, and that doesn't require a permit, I don't think.
Well, it was, but the example that I'm familiar with, it was done on San Gabriel Dam in L.A. County many years ago, but they raised the spillway approximately 2 to 3 feet, saved thousands.
Fill the dam, and of course it spilled in early 1969. I also remember that in 1983, that 78,000 acre feet of water went over the spillway. So this reservoir system can fill and spill in one heck of a hurry if we get a wet cycle going. And it's worth our while, I think, to press on here. Any further questions for Mr. Benedix on this issue? How about the quagga mussel infestation response plan?
Okay. Probably should have had the HCP next, but to give us a break on the intensity of the spillway, we'll talk about the quagga mussels for a minute. Just briefly to advise you that the General Services, Parks and Rec Department, and Public Works gave a joint presentation to the County Board of Supervisors on the issue of the quagga mussels and the potential and what we were doing to try to protect the Lopez and Santa Margarita Lake from infestation. And I don't recall if I've described to you that the details, Mr. Gehring. Did we talk about the Parks Department doing the actual cleaning of the boats? Has that been described to everybody?
I think it has.
Okay, all right. A presentation was made to the board describing that. In every boat since I believe the weekend before Memorial Day has been washed and inspected and tagged or not let in to both reservoirs. The board's actions as a result of that, they agreed that we would continue to do the inspections. Every boat, there's a tagging system that allows repeat boats who have been cleaned to go back to the facilities, both at Santa Margarita and at Lopez, and in an interchangeable manner, so the locals, people don't have to go through that inspection and decontamination procedure or waste time or money on both parks and the public's part. They also agreed that they would work cooperatively with Santa Barbara County on the Kachuma Lake. The tags that they're using, the inspection procedures, the protocol that they're doing the infestation, or the, excuse me, the cleaning with is also the same protocol that Santa Barbara County is using. So that's a distribution. Monterey County does not use that for potable distribution, and that is a contact lake where people swim, obviously, in that lake. But that meeting hasn't happened yet. The supervisor is going to try to convince them that there should be some decontamination done also at Lake Nacimiento, but that is not being done. They're basically doing a public awareness campaign, and that's all that we're aware of at this time. So that's what is happening now. The Public Works Department, I am coordinating a preparation of an infestation response plan, and I'm doing that jointly with funding from Zone 3 and funding matching funding from the City of San Luis Obispo, and we anticipate that we will come up with a response plan that will evaluate both Santa Margarita facilities and Lake Lopez facilities to determine what our awareness and our actions would be if we found that we had an infestation in either lake, how we would respond to that, and what we would do to provide for maintenance of continuing satisfactory facilities. There's no getting rid of the mussels unless you drain. The first two options are you kill everything in the lake with chemicals or you drain the lake and let it dry. We're not going to do either of those two things at either of those two lakes, so those kind of are out the window. But we will identify the facilities, what we kind of actions we would take. We don't want to go out and do design work and buy a bunch of equipment or do a bunch of things that we don't need to, but we want to identify what the immediate steps would be if we did find the mussels in the lake. We are doing sampling. As I mentioned before, the sampling is done every month. And I have been advised by Monterey County staff that they would like to cooperatively work with us to participate in an infestation response plan. However, my calls to Monterey County have gone unanswered, and I'm not going to wait for them because Lake Nacimiento is probably immensely more difficult to try to control and deal with the quagga mussels than Lopez or Santa Margarita. Particularly, we don't have any control over that. And if we did Nacimiento, we'd probably add San Antonio to it also. So if they want to come up with funding and have us do a joint project, that's okay, but I'm not. An emergency action plan is what it would be if we end up finding the mollusks there in the lake.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Ashton.
Yeah. Dean, I know one thing that troubled me with this mollusk that we're dealing with here is the cost factor, and I think that's the horrendous part of the whole thing there. Currently now, the responsibility, if I understand you, for the inspection and all that, it's done by the parks or system as far as that goes. What happens if we do get infestation? Then who takes over control of combating the mussels? Does that stay with the parks deal, or does that become a county-wide problem? Also, to go along with that, you and I have had discussions in the past. Since it's a statewide problem and that the state refuses to take any responsibility, isn't that true on a local level? They say it's your problem and you need to fight it and that there. So do you have any comments along that line?
That's correct. The state has not offered, as far as I'm aware of, to any of the facilities or the agencies that have been infested. They are trying to pass some legislation to legislate maintenance of non-infestation, and that's not really possible, but they're trying to encourage people to not do stupid things and to take precautions to, you know, have clean and dry boats in the new facilities. That's pretty limited as far as that response goes. As far as the cost, as you mentioned, we have discussed that a little bit. At this point, if Santa Margarita Lake were to be infested, it's going to affect the City of San Luis Obispo. It's their water. And they would have to pay for whatever retrofit facilities were necessary to do and maintenance of those facilities. At this point, the scope of things that we see are pretty limited. The normal types of things we would anticipate is the screens, the intake screens that take the water from the lake, whether Lopez or Santa Margarita, whether there's one or five intakes, those screens likely would get clogged. They'd have to be cleaned or replaced or rotated so that the water could get into the pipeline. We're not really aware of how far the creatures go into the pipeline. It depends on velocity. It depends on water. It depends on darkness. And so it would just be another type of a maintenance thing that we have to do. That's the obvious initial thing. There's things such as installing a chemical injection at the pipe intakes. If you got suction air, you don't worry about the chemical bleeding back into the lake as long as you have a positive suction into your pipeline to a certain extent. We could kill anything going into the pipeline because it's going to be killed eventually anyway. There's been some discussions about magnetic and electrical low voltage type of things. I can't imagine anything terribly sophisticated. You know, the scary numbers that the Great Lakes has put out is billions of dollars in their facilities, and I still haven't had anybody explain to me why it's billions of dollars over the last 20 years. Why haven't they done something to reduce billions of dollars? But once they're in the system, I guess they just deal with it. I don't know what their systems looked like back there, but that's a long answer to say, yeah, it would be Zone 3 paying for whatever replacement maintenance of the facilities. Certainly there's the case for requesting or asking or demanding or however you wanted to put it of the county or of, for example, the city say, well, you guys you allowed this to happen to our water. We want some reimbursement. I don't know that, you know, I don't see that it's a tremendous expense at this point. The biggest expense I would imagine would be having to hire divers to go in there and replace the stuff. And we haven't made the assessment of how often would our screens get fouled up. How long does that take? The only thing we know for sure, I think, at this point is that if we get them in there, we'll have them in there forever. And maybe even the bigger question is if we get them in there, they'll end up in the river or in the creek. And what will they do to Arroyo Grande Creek? We don't have an answer to that question either. I don't know if that's a bad thing, it's a good thing, if it's neutral. I don't know, but they do affect not only the physical functioning of the water flow, but they do affect the organic or the environmental constituency of that water. They consume organics or what is it called? I want to say plankton, but I'm not sure that's the right word. But they consume food in the water that the fish drink. They probably consume oxygen, so they do have an impact on the water. To what extent a large reservoir, I mean, they're all probably different. Probably a larger impact on the terminal reservoir because it's much shallower. The owner of the property ends up with the problem and has to take care of it operationally.
Kind of a follow-up question there. I noticed in the paper not too long ago that they're doing inspections up at Lake Tahoe. And if I remember correctly, that lake kind of falls in two states. There is a state taking responsibility for addressing the mussel up there, or where does that responsibility fall upon?
I'm not aware of any of the articles that I've seen. John, has your staff done any research into anything with respect to that? The Water Quality Lab, this is John Beaton. Lisa Wallander of the Water Quality Lab is working with some of this information, but I haven't seen anything that indicates that the state is taken any responsibility other than the state fish and game, Department of Fish and Game, is providing services about protocols and inspections. They are doing testing also. The state has sampling stations at Nacimiento, right, John?
We installed with the state sampling devices at Lopez and Santa Margarita.
Okay.
One in each of those. The state biologist has been working with us to help us out. They're kind of learning as they go along too. They have an agreement with university in Oregon to do some testing for them, and if we wanted to look at villagers, we could actually send some samples to them for a time being. They have a limited amount of money, but their own testing takes priority. But as far as You know, what they're doing at Lake Tahoe, such we don't know.
Yeah, I haven't heard of any. I know San Diego County is basically, I believe, 80 to 90% of their lakes are infested. Everything on the Colorado and Mississippi is infested. But I don't know the magnitude or volume of that. Because you end up being an interagency or interstate, and then the states kind of bail out of that. So I'm not aware of any state assistance.
It seems to me that the state ought to certainly get interested in this, because we start looking at the Sacramento River with boats going up there. They're not treating any of the boats that go on the Sacramento River all the way up to Redding.
There has been a study done by a consultant for the state water system, and I know the state water system is.
Oh, we got a question from the audience. Please come forward.
Marilee Hyman. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Benedict mentioned earlier in the meeting that he was not testing for the larvae stage of the quagga mussels, that it is too expensive to test. I was curious as to how much it costs per test, and if in their future planning for the quagga mussels, he sees an advantage in initiating testing.
Can you answer that?
I'll need Mr. Beaton to answer a half of that question. It's my understanding that it takes 6 months to get the test back after you submit it. I think that's what Lisa told me, John. Do you know about the cost?
I don't, but it does take a number of weeks to get results back. Again, I think Fish and Game in California was sending samples to this, I believe it's a university in Oregon, to actually do the testing. There just aren't a lot of people that are set up to identify the villagers. We're looking at it ourselves to see if it's something we can develop in-house, or even if it would be worthwhile for us to send somebody to obtain training someplace else. I've talked with their local public health laboratory, the microbiologists there. They've looked into it and have said it just it's beyond their capability as well right now. So it is expensive. It isn't a rapid turnaround. It's a different kind of a sampling event at the lake, as opposed to the devices that we put in there and waiting for the villagers to land on those and to grow in it. Talking with the fish and game biologists, they actually thought that was probably the best way to approach it at this point in time. Rather than taking plankton nets and dragging that through the lake to look for the villagers, there's so many other plankton and such there that it is difficult to separate the villagers from that. And if you do have villagers there, in our particular case, you would have mussels growing as well. And we're just trying to find the mussels first.
Yeah, it's difficult because we're not aware of any early treatment program. And that's kind of frustrating, because we're sampling for larger meaning, gosh, I don't know, probably is about as big as the toponative action toward trying to keep them out of the lakes. For example, our decontamination procedure, if you will, they were a lot more successful in keeping out of the lakes than those people that just said, we're going to get them anyway, so whatever, you know. But I got no statistics to back that up, and certainly it only takes one boat, you know, to do that. So, and we know they're close, and I mean, I can't imagine there not being one boat that's going to get into Lake Nacimiento from someplace else at the wrong time. We just don't know. I don't think we're even aware of how long it takes from, if one were to get in there, how long it would take to grow on our sampling equipment, even though the sampling equipment is right near the docks where the boats go in. It's like, well, why would they go over there or somewhere else? I mean, I just, there's no controlling this thing. So, but the only good news is we're doing all we can at our two lakes, and that's about the best we can do it now. We're just not aware of any other technology. We are hoping, and we are hearing of people who are coming out with, you know, new technologies in California because they're aware of this program, and some people who like to do this kind of thing to develop innovators and inventors, coming up ways to do electromagnetic something or whatever to keep them from going in the facilities. But as far as treating of the individual boats, we're doing about all we can.
All right. Thank you for that. Mr. Ashton.
I just found some Merrill. Just pass on to Dean here. And I knew I kept the article there on regard to Tahoe over there. And apparently about the 16th of May, and it's going to continue on through the to the end of the summer boating season there, they instituted random inspections of boats going into Lake Tahoe. And this is under the auspice of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, also in conjunction with the Fish and Game of both California and Nevada, working with them on a thing. And because they feel if they should get into the lake, it'd be a major threat. And I think it'd be a major threat to any of our lakes it gets into where that goes. And one of the things they developed to detect the mussel on these inspections is the training dogs to sniff them out. And currently the Fish and Game in this state has 12 dogs. They got two of them assigned to Tahoe, and they can smell out one live mussel on a boat. And that there. So I'll pass it on to you there.
Okay. You have it there. Yeah, I think, yes, again, as we do try to bring these topics to the Technical Advisory Committee before we bring them to your full advisory committee, we have been discussing a modification to our HCP submittal, the modification is a strategy for attraction flows for the fish. Obviously, the HCP's primary concern is for the fish and fish passage, and we have prepared, or our consultant has prepared, a modified HCP proposal, which is one facet of the HCP. And we're just about finished with that. We brought it to the Technical Advisory Committee and explained it to them, and we have their concurrence regarding it. There's four elements of this modification that I think we've discussed before, and I'll just briefly go over them. The strategy for this, for the fish passage and the attraction from Lopez Dam for the fish, is to time releases to provide the maximum benefit for fish without impacting the storage objectives for the dam. That's a good thing because we have recognition and acknowledgement that from the resource agencies that it is a water supply facility too, and that's a major accomplishment. The four issues that we are giving them information and proposing to modify the HCP include: to avoid passage releases, which would be environmental releases, during dry years. And based on some of the information I just gave you before, you know, it would seem to indicate that we have about 50% dry years, depending on the period of time that you look over the span of dry versus wet years. But we would propose to avoid passage releases during the dry years, to avoid passage releases if the sandbar at the beach is not open, because if the sandbar is not open, the fish can't get into the creek from the ocean. The third thing is to target releases to the tail end of a storm flow during the creek's recession. In other words, you get a flush down the creek, and at the end of that flush down the creek, you have enough water for an attraction for the fish to come in, and the resource agencies are saying, well, at the end of that flush down the creek, as the water subsides, we want to put some water into the creek to extend that attraction releases. And we're going to put a gauge in at the lagoon, which will tell us if we have a sudden drop in water level, we'll know that's probably had a sandbar breach because the water went out into the ocean. Then we'll be physically looking at that. So these are the four items that we are proposing to include, and we're going to be submitting these to National Marine Fisheries Service. We have specific definitions of each of these, what a dry year means, how many acre feet of water come into the lake. There's specific, so there's a clear understanding of what these mean. And usage of these should save us water, and they will not result in any reduction of the safe yield of the dam, as we has been analyzed by our consultant. So these are all good things that we see happening, giving us more control and opportunity here. So we anticipate providing these and getting comments back, reviewing them with National Marine Fisheries Service. And then ultimately, and I would assume within hopefully the next 3 or 4 months, we will reach a concurrence and be able to revise the HCP and submit that revised HCP back to National Marine Fisheries Service so they can comment on the entire document and we can move this thing along. So that's the conclusion of my report, Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Benedict, as far as the working relationship with the National Marine Fisheries, does that seem to be progressing on a more positive note than in the past?
Yes, it does. As you know, we submitted a letter to them sort of complaining about the long length of time and money. They responded back to us that they were committed to getting it done. We needed to do our part, and we responded back thanking them for that. And trying to keep them focused on what was going to happen next. And we see that they are doing their part right now. Could be moved faster, but they're maintaining interest and priority on it. So that's about all we can really ask of them now.
And Mr. Costello.
Dean, if you said it takes about 3 or 4 months for this to be submitted right now for their comments, and then it'll come back, and then we'll submit the entire HCP for approval. What are we looking at in terms of estimated time frame now?
I'm trying to recall. We our initial letter to National Marine Fisheries within the last 3 months request.
Anything?
Nothing further at this point.
Mrs. Dean? No? Ted, you usually have a comment on this issue.
I'm kind of saving my comments here, I guess, for new business on this. Really, I don't know if this is the place or not, but I think I best bring this up at new business. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Right.
Any other questions for Mr. Benedict on the HCP processing status? It does look like we're to new business, and as far as I know, there's none scheduled. Mr. Benedict, do you have anything?
No, I don't, Mr. Gehring.
And I know Mr. Earing does, so we'll start with you.
Okay. And my new business is that when I brought this up, I guess I brought it up at the last meeting or the meeting before that. But anyhow, what I brought up was the idea that, and I think here that Dean made reference to it, on the basis that we're putting 5.5 million gallons per day down the creek now, which is 1.5 million gallons per day that we don't have to put down there to keep the fish alive, but basically the farmers ask for this. And I was kind of waved off at that meeting as I said that I didn't think that it was a very good idea or that it was legal for the farmers to extract or throw a pump over the side and extract water to irrigate. That basically their riparian rights require that they can drill wells and take it out of the groundwater, but they don't have any right to take the water out of the creek. And I was waved off on that and said that they had prescriptive rights to do that. I find that that's not the case. I find that they need to have a permit if they're going to be able to do that. And it also seems to me that, and I'm going to be very blunt about it, that prescriptive rights can't be gained by the fact that you've been stealing water for the last 10 years or whatever that period of time might be. If that's an illegal action, I don't see how you am and giving it away and we're not receiving any money for it, that we should continue this process. And so I'd just like to hear comments from my colleagues as well as Dean as to how this might be approached, because I think the county ought to be out there and do something about this to stop this action.
Mr. Benedict, I thought we did we get an informal opinion out of Jan Goldsmith on that issue?
Yes, we did. And Jan advised us that they did have a right to pump water out of the creek.
And what is
there? Are you the general counsel for the county?
Yes, for the district, right, and the water resources, yeah. Now, probably need to separate the two things as far as a permit goes. We know from some problems we've had in the past, Fish and Game goes and looks at that creek. They know what's going on in that creek, because if they can find a 6-inch dead steelhead, they can certainly find a 150-horsepower motor with an 8-inch, 200-foot-long pump on it. So the question I had is, do they need a permit? Well, maybe they do, but nobody's telling them that they do, and I don't know if they do or not. I know the city of San Luis Obispo has similar issues on San Luis Obispo Creek, and I don't know whether there's prescriptive rights with respect to people who irrigate whatever their little mini orchards are out of San Luis Creek. I think they monitor that pretty closely. But we haven't delved into that issue. I think probably mostly because of there is we have a responsibility and a requirement to do have environmental releases. It's in the contracts that we have, and it keeps the resource agencies from coming after us and suing us for stopping releases and having it our fault that there's no water in the creek, regardless of whether the amount we put in is right, wrong, you know, too much, too little. And that's I think averages out about 4 million gallons a day. I'm not sure whether the farmers, I have some reports that they are taking more water out of the creek in recent years than they have been pumping in recent years. I guess previously they were pumping more water, and why they are or not, I'm not sure, but that's kind of what I understand. I think the water all ends. I had a concern about, well, how high are we going to go? Where do we stop with this? You know, I don't think the farmers have a right to dictate to us that every time they need more water or their crop rotation or, you know, the weather says we got to let more water out. And the Public Works Director, Pablo Ogren, has confirmed that. He says, you know, at some point we have a responsibility, but at some point we don't. It's not very clear. We are trying to avoid the messiness and the extensive legal hassles and issues of adjudication by, I don't know if it's going to come out right, but probably trying to reach a consensus about providing additional water in the interim until we get the HCP completed and we know what our real responsibilities are, because the club we have over us, if we reduce the water too much and there's a fish kill, then it's our fault. There's nobody else's fault out there unless we can find somebody. You know well as I do that fish get sucked up into those pumps and we never see them again. That's life if you're a fish, if you're a farmer, and that's okay. But it's not clear, and I think if we were to go down that path, at some point we probably will need to, because water is going to be that valuable. There's not a clear direction to go or a line to be drawn on what we do with that. Although, as I said, before I did anything to tell my operators to increase the flows over 6 million gallons, I would go talk to the Public Works Director, and you know Pablo's pretty up on what the water rights and responsibilities are there, and I would probably have his yes or no before we did anything like that, because to me that's kind of the upper limit of what we would do. So it's been working, I guess. I think some of the technical advisory committee members have mentioned that we in fact do release more environmental releases than our contract requires. I think we've discussed that, several hundred acre feet, I believe. But that gets messy because we're not sure what our responsibility really is, and all we know is there's a lot of liability at the back end of that issue. So no, we're not releasing 1,000 acre feet a year as compared to our, is it 3,200 or 3,400 is our contractual responsibility for environmental releases. It's a minor part, but it is extra more than we're aware of that we have to, but we, I guess we're figuring that that's the better part of valor now, is not to either be right or wrong, to be cooperative, because it's not worth it.
We're talking about some of our agencies, our local agencies out here, i.e. Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach, and that are having problems with drinking potable drinking water, to suck that potable drinking water out and make us send more water out down the creek from the very beginning, doesn't seem like that's the proper thing to do. And we're talking about a $5 million cost to $4.5 million to increase the level of the dam so we can store more water, but yet we can't store water because farmers are taking it out downstream when they're not supposed to. And the percolation through groundwater and the time for the runoff of this water is I find that, yeah, they can begin to suck water with by creating a drawdown from pumping, but pretty soon this becomes pretty expensive, and I'm sure that they're not going to want to. The farmers are not going to want to do that. But beside that, I mean, I don't. Without a permit, I find that. You know, they're illegally taking drinking water from local agencies with no payment, no consideration, and it's kind of a good old boy thing that's been going on for a good many years. And it's not proper. It's not right. And so I'd like to hear from the other colleagues and from the other cities here or local agencies that are having this serious difficulties in providing water, that we're in this drought season, we're beginning to think that perhaps we're going to have to ration water or do something of that nature if it gets more severe next year. The farmers already in, let's say, in San Joaquin Valley area are being restricted on the amount of water that they can take out of the canals because that water is not going to be available. And we have another drought year. You're going to see farmers, agriculture in this state really suffer. So I think we ought to discuss this.
I'm a little bit confused here. I hear you saying that they're taking the water illegally, and yet I hear...
As to whether they have a right to take that water out of the creek. Okay, our council is telling us they do, and I think Pismo's council is telling them that they don't. I understand correctly. Is that right?
That's correct.
Right. The second issue is, do they need a permit from State Fish and Game because they're taking water out of that creek? And I can see a lot of scenarios why, if I called Fish and Game and asked them that question directly, that the farmers could call and ask them some other questions directly that wouldn't be a benefit to our Zone 3 operations either. So I would be reluctant to do that. But that's a fair question. I'm not looking for any more work, and I'm not sure that would save me any water or make anybody happy. All I can tell you is I am very concerned every time they call and talk to us and say, hey, the water's drying up, we need more water. And there's a certain threshold that if it were to be approached, and in my thinking it's around 6 million gallons a day, because every time I hear we're going to go up another half or a million gallons a day, I think about how many people that serves for a year, and that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. That's correct.
And I'm aware of that. So I don't have any direction from my boss to change the operation that we've had for quite a while. And I don't know whether, you know, Mr. Runnels is not here, but whether some type of an informal discussion might be beneficial to have. Any discussion with attorneys doesn't really come out very cordial, especially if they don't agree on something besides all the other disagreements. So I guess I'm saying I don't know we have a strategy of how to address that. Mr. Ehring is correct. City of Pismo Beach has brought it up a couple times at the TAC meeting, and we've said, well, here's the district's expert opinion on it, and we don't see there's any action we need to take. I think if we were talking about releasing 10 million gallons a day or something, it's like, well, wait a minute, you know, that's way outside our environmental releases. We're not going to be doing that. So it relies on in some sense on the, what do they call it, the farmers have a credibility in their farming operations or reasonableness of what they do, you know, how they plant, rotate, all that kind of stuff. I guess we kind of rely on some of that from their perspective, too, to understand they need to be reasonable with their requests to us.
If we release 4 million gallons a day, does that hit the 3,400 acre feet a year?
I don't know if that translates, what that translates to a number. But I can tell you the way...
I mean, if that 4 million gallons per day is what's needed in order to keep the... you know, to keep the steelhead, keep the river flowing, okay, to a certain point where it's, you know, flowing downstream all the way, I guess, down to the lagoon.
Right, and part of the impreciseness of what we do with that is the environmental releases are not defined. The contracts don't define those are fish releases, or those are salamander, or those are vegetation, or riparian, or groundwater recharge. That's not defined. Are they agriculture? I'm not even sure agriculture is mentioned in there, but they're environmental releases, and whether that is covered under that definition, I'm not sure. But that's really our target. That's kind of our responsibility to provide that. So we see order of magnitude over, or hopefully someday under, that would be reasonable to predict, because it adjusts every week. It changes every week. It changes with each storm. So I guess we don't see the benefit being worth the risk that we're taking and jumping on that wild bull, if you will.
Is there a way that we could find out how much water the farmers are pulling out?
Got to conduct an inspection.
I think that would be like finding how many cattle are being grazed on somebody's private property. They're very... We do have, you know, we do have a water monitoring program, and we go out every month, and we do measure the well depths. And we have to do that in cooperation with the property owners, because we are on their private property looking at their private well, measuring their private water level, I guess, if you will. And they could say no, and we could have no information. I think they would probably be suspicious if we started reading meters or asking questions or whatever. That would be an effort to do. And I think it'd be an effort, be much more satisfying if it was done in a cooperative sense. And to me, maybe that's, you know, it'd be nice to have an informal forum of farmers and agency representatives to discuss, here's concerns we have, what are we doing, and how's it working for everybody. That's what I would suggest, because if it gets more complicated, it gets more complicated.
What they had when they were originally taking water out? So if, and you talk about legal adjudication of this water, and being a very messy thing, but it might be a good idea to at least establish some sort of a gentleman's agreement between what the farmer is going to take out of this creek and what you put down there out of the dam. And maybe that limit should be considerably less than 6 million if we have people that do not have water to drink.
No, I agree with you. As my thought was, we need to know what our releases equate to with respect to our total annual contract amount. How we administer that, it doesn't say. If we have no releases during the wintertime, then we make up for those during the summertime. That makes a lot of sense. If we're running away, the problem is that there's multiple farmers doing multiple crops, changing their schedule all the time. And I'm not sure it's really possible. You know, we have one release point that recharges the aquifer. They can use wells. They may not use wells. They pump out of the creek. I don't think it's functionally manageable, except for the point of what we release and how we administer that is based on 10 people's extraction points and their rotational farming and the extent of water that they need and the weather. That's even tough to do on that point. So I'm saying I think we need to know that, and we bump up, you know, if it's 3.6 million gallons a day is the average throughout the year, well, then at some point in time, and we keep track annually of how much we release, at some point we're going to say, hey, you know, we're sorry it's hot, and we're sorry that you just planted a bunch of stuff, but, you know, we're at the top of our limit, and we can't raise it anymore. And that's when we're going to have a problem at that point. You see hundreds of acres drying up because somebody can't get water out of there, and wells are not available. I don't know why. The wells may be available, it just may be more expensive. There's a lot of questions to be answered with respect to this, and I'm not even sure we have a baseline, Mr. Ehring. I would like to have one.
Well, yeah. I would like to think that, you know, we have a gentleman's agreement in some basins with Arroyo Grande, okay, mm-hmm. considering pumping and stuff. And they've worked very well between the two agencies, and we've had very good relationships, and it's which is taking place up that, you know, in that area. And then at some point in time go into some kind of a legal fight or something, which is not desirable, as you say, mm-hmm. and then cut them off, and they're expecting to be able to continue to grow grapes and so forth and so on, and then all of a sudden you cut off their water, which would be as damaging to them financially as it would be as if we sat down. And I think that this is probably the place to generate that gentleman's agreement. So that's about all I have to say about it, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to hear from my colleagues.
Mr. Ash.
I just want to remind Ted here that I believe in the gentleman agreement. Grover Beach is involved in that, considering that your wells, both of them, are located over in Grover Beach and out there. And so I think it is a kind of a gentleman agreement. It is a three-city involvement as far as that goes.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I didn't mention Grover Beach, but that's true. We're all in that, and it's worked very well.
Yes.
And Oceano.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to.
And the farmers.
Mr. Costello, did you calculate anything over there?
Well, I was taking a look at it, and if you know, just looking at how many acre feet we're releasing, if we release 4 million gallons a day average and 3 million gallons a day average, it seems to me like we need more information before we can go anywhere and do anything with this. Ultimately, I think some sort of a meeting of the minds where we get everyone together and talk about this in a non-threatening environment is certainly probably going to be very productive. Now, this is a public meeting. Farmers are listening to us right now. Mm-hmm. So we don't need to go out and look at their wells for them to start to get suspicious. The issue's raised, and I think that it needs to be discussed in more detail. I don't know. I don't like bringing the lawyers out and starting to charge forward with that. I think we need to get together and talk about this and see what's going on. And if we're only talking about 100 acre feet a year or 200 acre feet a year, granted, that's a significant amount of water. 200 acre feet a year, Arroyo Grande has the rights to half that, so that's 100 acre feet a year. We could use 100 acre feet a year, no question. But it sounds to me like you're talking about some of the risks that we...
It's bad enough. We are monitoring wells and doing that kind of thing. And I know downstream there are springs and things like that that contribute to the creek water also. But I think the water is going to be a problem for this area, for it's coming on and it will be that way forever, and it doesn't hurt to start talking. And talking with the farmers and talking with the users, I'm sure that we could be more frugal in our use of water, the cities and the people that are using the water. And I look at the things I do and I'm thinking, okay, 3-minute shower, that's all you should be taking, those kinds of things. So I think we can we can work on the people who use the water as much as the farmers and maybe get more water that way too by talking about conserving. So talking with everybody is good, but also initiating conservation types of things and raising people's awareness because we're all in this together.
Mr. Ashton.
Just one point there. In fact, I believe Dean was present at that meeting. I think he was one of our RAC meetings, recent one, that I don't think it was the last one, in the special meeting, the one before that, that one of the gentlemen that has been ongoing monitoring the court case that took place there, and it's not exactly truly over yet, because it was brought up at that meeting that the I believe it's the farmers' interests are appealing the judge's decision or ruling on that case there, and so it's not fully over yet as far as the legal aspect of things. So some of these things have a habit of going on and on and on. So the final act has not, the curtain hasn't fallen yet on settling that case there. It could even go to some other change on that thing here.
From the audience, a question.
Merrill Lee Hyman. Mr. Chair, you say that the wells are inspected going up the creek area, so you know the property owners. Do you know how many farmers there are next to the creek?
I think there's a total of around 5 in that area.
Not very many, so there's probably more farmers.
And those are all voluntarily made accessible to us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The downstream release rate that is currently being conducted, to my recollection, dates back to 2 different agreements. The earliest is an agreement that I think may be part of the contracts, the water supply contracts for the zone, that indicates that we will release up to 4,200 acre feet for agricultural purposes downstream. But then there was a later agreement that is apparently an informal agreement reached by county staff, between county staff, or Zone 3 staff in this case, and the resource agencies to maintain a certain level of downstream release for environmental purposes. I'm not really sure, and maybe Mr. Wallace may recall, exactly how much water we're obligated to release for that particular purpose, or how it combines with the agricultural release. And I guess my suggestion is that we send this back to technical committee and have them flesh out or thresh out, find out what those values are, so that we know what our contractual obligation might be.
Yes, I believe we have a minimum flow level at Biddle Park. I think that's our monitoring. John, is that right?
No.
Yeah, there's one point in the creek that we have to maintain a live stream. I don't know if there's a capacity on that at that point, and I don't know which agreement that is, Mr. Gehring. This would be part of trying to put a baseline of here's our requirements and responsibilities by whatever contract, and here's what we're doing, and start a discussion. You know, I'm just thinking, if I was a farmer and you guys were going to do something different, I'd like you at least to tell me so I wouldn't plan on doing something, then you came in and just shut the door on me. That would be a real bad way to handle that.
So go ahead, Mr. Wallace.
Just some overview comments. Number one, water law is complicated, as we all know. I've been through seminars and courses and so forth. It's difficult sometimes to come to firm conclusions, and that's the way that lawyers make their living. But going back to the original agreement that Jim talks about, the 4,200 acre feet, I think, is being unfairly characterized by farmers. I think the wording in the agreement was for downstream users, which included all riparian users. When you have droughts, you have pumpage, you have other conditions that demand more or less water that gets released to the creek. So I agree with Jim and Dean here. Maybe we go back to the TAC and thrash this around a little bit as to how the environmental and the downstream users' entitlement relate to one another, and I think that it's subsumed within each other. I think the environmental releases are part of the 4,200 acre feet, personally. But maybe look at more of the operational techniques that might satisfy both all parties in this kind of a thing.
So, Mr. Wallace, your suggestion is take it back to TAC?
I think it would be a good idea, and perhaps to make sure that we perhaps invite Mr. Reynolds to that meeting to give. He's got an amazing amount of history behind these discussions, and, of course, he is in the business of farming, so I think that he can relate for our benefit some of the history behind these discussions.
Okay.
I think that's a good idea. How did the other committee members feel on that? Looks like we have a consensus on your idea, Mr. Wallace.
Well, I think Ted brought it up, so is that okay with you?
Yeah, that sounds very good to me. I wanted to bring this issue up and see if we couldn't address it. And as you pointed out, Dean, this has been brought up by Pismo Beach probably, two or three times in the past. And I don't know that it's ever been solved, that it's ever been, I'm certainly with Pamela over here. I don't want to see another litigation like we had through that. And I think the way to handle this is basically through Zone 3 and somewhat with the farmers and get some kind of a gentleman's agreement, but kind of firm it up so that we're not continually taking that water and using it to expand agriculture. Certainly we all see the grape growers around here, and we encourage having a farming community and that sort of thing. But still in all, I think we have responsibilities to the people to see that they're not going to have to go without water. So thank you.
I think the last couple of years that Dean's been involved with it, it's been really good to have the complete reports he's been giving us, and I'd just like to commend him for that.
Thank you.
I think we would all echo that comment. Any other committee member comments? Any committee member have any issue they'd like to raise? Mr. Ashton.
I got one comment here. Yeah, I want to comment, Dean, compliment Dean and the staff there for providing invaluable information. I just wondering, somewhere down the line, if the public out there truly appreciates what's behind turning that tap on and getting that glass of water over there, if they knew all the complications there. Discussed here and at. Do we put any PNR out on occasions to let them know, possibly maybe once a year, to let them know that all the things that have gone on? Because we do hear from them quite often when we raise rates on home water and that. Maybe they ought to know a little bit about what's behind the costs going on there. I mean, even myself, well, I'm somewhat involved in it here. I'm overwhelmed by it. What's going on behind the scenes there? Do you have anything going in line?
We do have a consumer confidence report that goes out every year. It is a state requirement that puts out the contaminant levels that we have tested and sort of reassures everybody what we're doing and brings them up to date. And John Beaton's staff, the chemists do prepare those documents, and they try to use some creativity and enjoyment in that and put some pictures in there and let them know we did the upgrade and those type of things. So we do distribute that and try to update people. We don't have the fire trucks that run down the street to be able to put sirens on, but I would like to do that sometime. I think I joked with you that I wanted to have a parade when they brought the membrane equipment in up the street, but I missed the opportunity to do that. I guess it was three trucks. They were pretty big trucks, and people looked like, what is that stuff going out there? I thought it was for an oil well or something, but I was kidding with all the contractors that we should have done that. But a consumer conference report is an attempt to do that, yes.
Thank you.
Each of the cities and districts has its own newsletter that goes out. That would be an appropriate spot for that kind of communication. And Mr. Ashton or I could write an article for the Sea Breeze, perhaps.
That's Good idea. I know we just got through.
Put it in the water bills.
Right. I know we just got through releasing a actual physical report, I think, on our water.